Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. In this episode, number 70, I'm going to take a break from the daily and weekly unfolding catastrophe of the COVID-19 pandemic and epidemic in the U.S. I'd like to back up a little bit and take a look at the larger issues in this pandemic, such as vaccines, immunizations, and drug therapies. I have five articles I want to cover, and then I'm going to actually do a repeat of a show on immunizations I did last year as a good background, historical and eternally relevant about the importance in public health of vaccinations. But for today, let's start with an article from The Hill. Lobbying battle brewing over access to COVID-19 vaccine. The race for COVID-19 vaccine is setting off a different kind of competition in Washington. Who will get it first? Food suppliers argue the workers should be near the front of the line. 15 trade groups recently made their pitch to President Trump, citing his declaration that the food and agriculture sector is a critical component of the nation's infrastructure. Trump administration officials have signaled they will take a tiered approach to giving out the vaccine when it is ready and said that, depending on the results of clinical trials, high-risk individuals, people with pre-existing health conditions, and frontline health workers will be prioritized. After those groups, it's anyone's guess. Will it be people at highest risk? Will it be people who are key to spreading transmission? Will it be politically effective lobby groups? Will it be people who can pay the most for it? Said Barry Bloom, a research professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. The nation's food industry thinks it has a strong case to make. Meat processing plants quickly became hotspots for the coronavirus, prompting several to temporarily close during the pandemic. Trump later signed an executive order to compel meatpacking plants to stay open. The North American Meat Institute, which represents meat processing companies, was among the 15 groups that sent a letter to Trump requesting priority access to a vaccine. Other groups on the letter included the American Frozen Food Institute, the National Milk Producers Federation, and the United Fresh Produce Association. Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the top Democrat on the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, said Trump needs to make that plan public now. The Trump administration needs to follow the science and address how to prioritize distribution now as a part of a larger, comprehensive national vaccine plan. And the cornerstone of that plan has to be public health and protecting vulnerable communities. We need to listen to the public health experts here, not the politicians, big corporations, or their lobbyists, she told The Hill in a statement. Bruce Gellin, former director of the National Vaccine Program, an office in the Department of Health and Human Services, said it is not too early to start discussing distribution plans. It's too hard to predict when a vaccine will be available, but it's not too early to start talking about the vaccination program because you don't want to have the vaccination ready and then announce a plan that nobody has seen, said Gellin, who is now president of global immunization at the Sabin Vaccine Institute. Some trade groups say now is not the time to jockey for a position. The National Restaurant Association, another group that signed onto the letter to Trump, argues that their workers should be considered just as vital as agriculture workers and others in the supply chain because the sector is interconnected. The groups in the letter also push for the federal government and not states to coordinate vaccine distribution. Leaving vaccine distribution to the states will result in an inconsistent, inefficient process, they wrote. Gellin agreed that the guidance has to come from the federal level for distribution. Bloom stressed that decisions about allocating a vaccine must be transparent. Since a vaccine will not be ready instantaneously to 342 million Americans, we need to have a public policy discussion for its distribution. Who should make the policy? And given the inevitable opposition of anti-vaccine activists, how do we assure a public consensus that it will be available in a fair and transparent way? Next, from MSN, as U.S. buys up remdesivir, vaccine nationalism threatens access to COVID-19 treatments. At the end of June, the United States government announced that it had secured the entire supply of remdesivir, an antiviral drug that shortens hospital stays for COVID-19 patients, until September. In March, there were reports that Donald Trump's administration tried to buy a German company working on a COVID-19 vaccine in order to secure the entire supply for the U.S. A group formed by France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands struck a deal in the past few weeks to secure 400 million doses of AstraZeneca's potential vaccine, although other countries are also encouraged to join the group on the same terms. Whether poor countries could afford the terms is another question. It certainly doesn't seem that we're all in this together. It looks more and more like a dog-eat-dog world. The group that's most likely to be eaten are those living in low- and middle-income countries. Gilead, the maker of remdesivir, has license agreements with manufacturers to supply remdesivir in 127 low- and middle-income countries, but those agreements exclude large middle-income countries such as Brazil, China, and Mexico. Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, is creating a facility that will enter into advanced purchase agreements with pharmaceutical companies guaranteeing the purchase of any eventual vaccines. But this proposal has generated significant global concerns about its impact on equitable access for populations, especially in developing countries. Under the agreement, rich countries will get the first crack at enough vaccine to cover 20% of their population, and only then will poor countries be granted the vaccine, and only for their highest priority populations. The cost of remdesivir in the U.S. is going to be about $390 per vial, which would amount to about $2,340 per five-day treatment course. It's estimated that remdesivir could be made for under $1 a dose, less than a quarter of 1% of what Gilead will be charging. At Gilead's price, the company could earn well over $2 billion in the first year the drug is on sale. The cost will hopefully be much lower in countries that are recipients of Gilead's licenses, but what about excluded countries? Gilead controls the supply of remdesivir because it holds the patent on the drug. When Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine, was asked if he was going to patent it, his famous response is, "There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" In other words, the vaccine was a public good meant to be used by everyone. Gilead obviously doesn't hold the same view about remdesivir, despite the fact that U.S. taxpayers contributed at least $70.5 million in developing the drug. Next up from Stat News, COVID-19 vaccine research must involve Black and Latinx participants. Here are four ways to make that happen. The development of a COVID-19 vaccine is progressing at an incredible pace, breaking down barriers to the invention, manufacture, and testing of potential vaccine candidates. The Department of Health and Human Services says it aims to have substantial quantities of a safe and effective vaccine available for Americans by January 2021. To achieve this goal, each of the five leading COVID-19 vaccine candidates will need to be tested in approximately 30,000 people, a total of 150,000 research participants in the next 6 months. This will be a massive and unprecedented undertaking. Equally unprecedented is the opportunity that COVID-19 vaccine development presents to break down barriers to the engagement of Black and Latinx individuals in clinical trials research. Ideally, vaccine trials should include participants from communities that have the highest risk of infection. In the case of COVID-19, those at-risk communities are disproportionately Black and Latinx. To match local demographics of COVID-19, Black or Latinx individuals would need to comprise up to 40% of vaccine trial participants nationwide. Clinical trials also establish the safety and effectiveness of new interventions, and there is no guarantee that the effects of an intervention will be the same across populations. Contemporary medical studies point to disparities in response rates to pharmacological therapies by race and ethnicity. No one knows for sure if such variances are products of socioeconomic realities faced by trial participants, a variety of environmental factors, or genetics, but they are real. Yet past experience shows that COVID-19 vaccine trials will likely have challenges meeting enrollment targets like these. In 2019, for example, the Food and Drug Administration approved 11 new cancer drugs based on clinical trials that enrolled just 4% of black participants, despite the fact that black individuals account for 13% of the U.S. population and have the highest death rate for most cancers. Most clinical trials are designed to enroll racially and ethnic diverse groups of participants and honestly aim to do that, but it's a hard goal to achieve. The hours that clinics are open are too limited for people of color whose employers prohibit taking off work. Study budgets don't always pay for interpreters and translations that would facilitate participation by non-English speakers. Study protocols often exclude individuals with chronic illnesses like diabetes and hypertension, which disproportionately impact people of color. The pressure to enroll participants and quickly accumulate data can be intense, especially in a pandemic, often eclipsing the goal of equitable representation. Another barrier to equitable clinical trial participation is the pervasive structural racism that is intricately woven into the fabric of our society. The U.S. has a shameful history of unethical experimentation on black men and women, from experimental surgeries performed without anesthesia on enslaved black women to the misappropriation of cervical tissue from Henrietta Lacks and the infamous Tuskegee syphilis study. This history has led to understandable and pervasive mistrust of clinical research. It is no wonder that black and Latinx patients often say to us, "I don't want to be a guinea pig in your experiments." Layered on top of this, strong anti-immigrant and sometimes xenophobic views that keep Latinx individuals and others who weren't born in the U.S. away from contact with healthcare institutions, including research groups. A recent survey conducted by the Pew Research Center demonstrates that how this sordid history and ongoing structural inequity could affect clinical trial participation. Even if a COVID-19 vaccine were available today and proven effective, only 54% of black adults would be willing to take it, compared to 74% of white adults. The statistics would likely be equally dismal for participation in COVID-19 vaccine trials. Everyone in medical research shares a responsibility to promote equitable representation for COVID-19 vaccine trials. Here are some ways we can do this. Step 1. Acknowledge the problem. We must recognize the importance of enrolling black and Latinx participants in these studies, even in the context of unprecedented rapid enrollment. Studies must report the demographics of trial enrollments while they are ongoing. Step 2. Provide appropriate funding to trial sites to support diversity initiatives. It takes money to translate informed consent forms, reimburse participants for transportation, staff clinics on weekends and nights, and advertisements in a broad array of neighborhoods and media outlets. It also takes money and institutional will to build a diverse research workforce that reflects affected communities and its representative of the country as a whole. Step 3. Address research mistrust by engaging communities now, at the beginning, not when it's time to share the final results. This means investigators need to meet with local stakeholders in black and Latinx communities, host webinars and virtual town halls, do interviews on community radio, and put themselves out there on social media. Step 4. Pay people back for trusting in the medical research community. We need to make any successful COVID-19 vaccine that comes out of this Herculean research effort accessible to everyone in the country, regardless of race, ethnicity, or the ability to pay for it. The fair and transparent distribution of an effective COVID-19 vaccine is paramount. Vaccines can be transformative. They have the potential to provide medical shelter against deadly diseases like COVID-19, allowing communities to safely emerge from this pandemic and rebuild. The recent protests against racism in the United States are calls to medicine and science too. Black and Latinx communities must be part of the critical endeavor to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. Next up from Stat News, the World Health Organization partners unveil ambitious plan to deliver 2 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines to high-risk populations. The World Health Organization and key partners unveiled a plan to purchase 2 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines for the highest-risk populations of the world. The plan anticipates that by the end of 2021, the doses could be delivered to countries to vaccinate high-risk individuals, likely including healthcare workers, people over the age of 65, and other adults who suffer from conditions like diabetes. The World Health Organization and its partners, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, estimated it will cost $18.1 billion to deliver on the plan. The effort is one pillar of the World Health Organization's effort to ensure all countries have access to COVID-19 vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics, called the ACT Accelerator, short for Access to COVID-19 Tools. In addition to the funding, $11.3 billion of which must be raised in the next 6 months, the project would also need commitments from high and upper middle income countries to purchase up to 950 million doses of vaccine. Countries will be offered shares of the 9 candidate vaccines that the coalition is supporting, as well as other vaccines the consortium may end up purchasing. The idea is that because it is not known which vaccines will be successful, purchasing shares in a pool to be called the COVAX facility will broaden a country's chance of having access to vaccines. It is expected that charitable donors will help support shares for low and middle income countries. Individual countries that can afford to do so are negotiating advanced direct purchase agreements with various manufacturers and are even helping to pay upfront for the cost of making vaccine before it has been shown to be effective. But should a country make a big investment in one vaccine only to see it fail, it could find itself with limited alternatives in the early days of vaccine availability when demand will be huge and supplies scarce. It's risky for them to do that, and it's also not ethically the right approach because it leaves the rest of the world without vaccine doses, said Soumya Swaminathan, World Health Organization's chief scientist. The risk is real. Vaccines are difficult to make, and historically more vaccine projects fail than succeed. Seth Berkley, CEO of Gavi, said about 7% of vaccines make it through preclinical development, and maybe 15 to 20% that enter the clinic are successful. The vast majority will fail, but having a large portfolio, this will move forward, Berkley said. He noted the facility has signed a memorandum of understanding for 300 million doses with AstraZeneca, which is partnering with Oxford University on vaccine that has already begun a phase 3 clinical trial. Richard Hatchett, SEPA's chief executive officer, said production support of a number of vaccine candidates gives COVAX a right of first refusal to vaccine doses, where the program has provided financial support for the manufacturing of the vaccine. The advantage of the facility is that it is the first customer in line for those projects where access agreements exist, but it can also go out to the market and buy any vaccine. And the large volume guarantees will be very attractive to companies, Hatchett said. According to the World Health Organization, there are currently 16 COVID-19 vaccines in clinical trials already, and at least another 125 in earlier stages of development. Next up, Stat News, U.S. withdrawal from World Health Organization threatens to leave it flying blind on flu vaccines. Twice a year, influenza experts from 10 institutions around the world meet at the World Health Organization Geneva headquarters to pore over mounds of data. At the end of the week-long meetings, they make decisions that affect people around the world, namely which variants of the flu virus should be used for vaccinations the following season. While the selections don't always hit the mark, influenza is notoriously hard to predict, it's the best process health officials have to keep flu vaccines up to date and try to protect people from the annual scourge. Now, with the pending withdrawal of the United States from the World Health Organization, the future of the process, or at least America's involvement in it, is in question. President Trump has criticized the Global Health Agency's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and other earlier health crises. He has cited this as rationale for withdrawing from the World Health Organization, which was established more than 60 years ago. Currently, the flu strain selection group includes 3 seats for institutions from the United States, which uses more flu vaccine than any other country in the world. It's unclear how the U.S. officials might try to preserve its role in the process or whether it could. Without access to the intelligence coming from other institutions at the table, the U.S. would be flying blind, said Nancy Cox, who retired from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2014 after leading the agency's influenza division for 22 years. For one thing, new flu variants don't typically emerge in the Americas. They often are first spotted in Asia. For another, countries that are reluctant to share viruses on a bilateral basis because of fears others will profit from them will often only share viruses with the World Health Organization. The risk to the U.S. wouldn't simply relate to seasonal flu vaccine. Participants at the meeting share important intelligence on animal flu viruses, avian and swine influenza, that could pose pandemic threats. Viruses that jump from animals to humans are called zoonoses. We won't know what's coming. You won't be aware of what's going on with respect to the zoonotic flu cases, said Cox. It would be a really difficult position to be in at CDC as head of the influenza division and not have access to the information to be able to keep people within the U.S. informed about the global threats that exist out there. Richard Webby is the director of one of the 10 institutions involved in the strain selection process, the World Health Organization Collaborating Center for Studies on the Ecology of Influenza in Animals, located at St. Jude Research Hospital in Memphis. It's one of six World Health Organization collaborating centers for flu research. The CDC also is a World Health Organization collaborating center, with the others located in Australia, Britain, Japan, and China. He too sees real problems in the U.S. can take if the U.S. can no longer take part in the strain selection process. I think if the U.S. collaborating centers are not at the table, actually hearing the discussions, seeing the in-depth analysis from the other collaborating centers, I think that would be a blow, said Webby. Four key regulatory agencies are also at the table, the Food and Drug Administration and counterparts from Australia, Britain, and Japan. Representatives of the collaborating centers at the World Health Organization meetings, armed with data submitted to them from national influenza laboratories in 125 countries around the world. In the months leading up to the meeting, scientists in the collaborating centers chart the genetic sequences of the thousands of flu viruses, but also test them to see how different they are from known circulating strains. The sequence of a virus may show mutations that might change the way the virus behaves, but it's only when the testing is done that one can see if the new variant appears to be able to evade the protection of the viruses selected for inclusion in the previous year's vaccine. If a variant that is successfully different seems to be gaining momentum and appears poised to becoming the dominating variant of the strain, H1N1 or H3N2, say, the experts will recommend flu vaccine manufacturers swap out the old version and replace it with a new variant. This process is done for four types of flu: the two influenza A viruses, H1N1 and H3N2, and the two influenza B viruses, known as B Victoria and B Yamagata. And it happens twice a year. The group looks for variants that are likely to cause the most problems in the coming Northern Hemisphere winter, the February meeting, and the Southern Hemisphere winter, the September meeting. Once the Northern Hemisphere selections are made, committees in the United States that advise the CDC and the FDA review the decisions. While they have a power to ask for changes for vaccines destined to the U.S. market, and they sometimes do, they are working from the data shared at the World Health Organization meeting. Malik Paris, a leading influenza expert at Hong Kong University, said the Flu Surveillance Network, Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System, would suffer if the U.S. partners can't participate because they're no longer part of the World Health Organization. But the bigger loser, he suggested, might be the United States. How on earth can the United States do proper global vaccine selection for the flu if they are working on their own? It's completely impossible, he said. Basically, they'll be forced to copy whatever's decided, because how can they get the data from the rest of the world? Webby said that wouldn't be in the interest of the U.S. It is often unclear which variants are likely to become dominant in the coming months. What looks important to one region may not seem like the best choice to another. So I think losing three votes for what is the best decision for the Americas, although it's a global decision, certainly the other collaborating centers have an intrinsic bias from what's circulating in their own regions, he said. He is also concerned about the U.S. capacity to stay on top of pandemic flu threats if it's not at the table for the strain selection meetings. As part of its pandemic flu preparedness work, the U.S. makes and stores in the Strategic National Stockpile doses of the vaccines against the animal flu viruses deemed to be the highest pandemic risk. Being inside the circle that are making these frontline decisions and getting access to the frontline data as it comes off is so vital, said Webby. You have to have that global picture to make sure you have the best vaccines. Of the roughly 500 million doses of flu vaccine made each year, the United States uses upward of 170 million doses, Cox said. The World Health Organization, which has said little about the threatened U.S. withdrawal, lauded the country's contribution to global influenza surveillance. Among the project's U.S. voluntary contributions to the World Health Organization support is the flu surveillance program. Cox fears that in that department may be lost, that jobs in that department may be lost with the withdrawal of U.S. funding. World Health Organization hopes that the technical institutions such as CDC will continue their technical collaboration within the surveillance network, spokesman Tarek Jazarevic said via email. The Trump administration has said it's reviewing the program in which it collaborates with the WHO, looking for alternative organizations to support the same kind of work. It has been reported that the United States may continue to interact with the World Health Organization, but only on issues that are deemed to be in the country's national security interest. The Department of Health and Human Services would not say if flu vaccine strain selection will be one such exception. Okay, well, that ends it for the news related to currently to COVID-19 vaccine development and obviously the influenza flu development that's dependent upon the World Health Organization collaboration. But now I want to replay a show from last year in last May, and it's important to know, because there's some reporting on the measles epidemic, that that measles epidemic is from last May of 2019, when we had an outbreak in the U.S. that was difficult to contain. Makes you wish for 2019 being in the COVID-19 epidemic pandemic today, but here it goes. Today I want to talk about vaccine-preventable infectious diseases, and I want to make it exceedingly clear that immunization with vaccines is of profound benefit to the 300-plus million people in the United States and to billions of people around the world. In fact, it is difficult to even imagine our world without vaccines. I dare say that a world without vaccinations would be a scary place, far scarier than any picture painted by so-called anti-vaxxers. What would our world look like without vaccines? Well, it wasn't that long ago that we lived in a world without vaccines. Smallpox killed over 300 million people in the 20th century. Smallpox was eradicated by 1979. I graduated from high school in 1979, and I've never known anyone with smallpox. Smallpox was eradicated. Eradicated. That means that we don't even have to immunize against it anymore. I don't have any tattoos, but I do have a cool scar on my left shoulder from my smallpox immunization as a kid in the 1960s. This scar seems to be, to me, to be a small price to pay for a world without smallpox. I'll gladly wear this scar as a reminder of the power of public health and vaccines. For those of you who have never had to live in a world with smallpox, I'll explain the reason for the scar. The smallpox vaccine was not given with a hypodermic needle. It was not a shot like many vaccinations. The vaccine was given using a two-prong needle that was dipped into a vaccine solution. When removed, the needle retained a droplet of the vaccine. The needle is then used to prick the skin 15 times in a few seconds. As the body develops a response to the vaccine, a scar is eventually formed. If one devastating disease eliminated isn't enough, how about a second? Polio. Polio paralyzed or killed more than 500 million people in the 20th century. Let me say that again. Polio paralyzed or killed more than 500 million people in the 20th century. Polio was eradicated from the Western Hemisphere by 1988. Just 30 years ago, the polio virus was widespread across 125 countries, causing millions to endure lifelong paralysis. Last year, there were polio virus infections in just two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, with only 33 confirmed cases reported worldwide. Today, our reawakening awareness of vaccine-preventable diseases not being prevented is due to the current measles outbreaks affecting 22 states. Measles was declared eradicated from the United States in 2000. Unfortunately, occasional measles cases acquired during international travel have found a foothold in locales with lower immunization rates. Borders don't stop measles, vaccination does. Back in 1963, at the time the measles vaccine was introduced, measles killed approximately 2.6 million deaths every year. Today, it has been reduced to 110,000. That's a 95% reduction. I'll talk a little bit more about the current measles outbreak in a little later in the show. The bottom line, overall, worldwide, vaccines continue to prevent an estimated 2 to 3 million deaths every single year. More recently, maternal and neonatal tetanus, an often fatal disease, has been eliminated in all but 13 countries because of vaccination of women before or during pregnancy. And promising results from nations that have introduced the human papilloma vaccine early suggest that cervical cancer is set to decline. Further, new vaccines are on the horizon to protect against some of our most dangerous known pathogens. The Ebola vaccine has already played a critical role in controlling the spread of the current outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Plus, the world's first ever malaria vaccine is being piloted in routine immunization programs starting this month in three African countries. I'd like to make a personal note on that. I was actually born in Haiti, and I did have malaria when I was a child. Partly, there is a pill that you can take as a prophylaxis to prevent malaria infection, but you have to take it at a certain age, and I actually contracted malaria prior to being old enough to take that preventive. And this is true with a lot of immunizations. Some of the vulnerable people are young children that are actually too young to take the immunization and therefore are vulnerable. But let me back up a little bit and review some of the currently available vaccines, which include cholera, dengue, diphtheria, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis E, human papillomavirus, HPV, influenza or the flu, several forms of encephalitis, malaria, measles, meningitis, mumps, pertussis or whooping cough, pneumococcal disease or pneumonia, polio, rabies, rotavirus, rubella, tetanus, tuberculosis, typhoid, varicella or chickenpox, and yellow fever. And there are a couple of dozen other vaccines that are in the pipeline. For those of you unfamiliar with some of these diseases, you may want to thank the wonders of vaccines and the anonymity of prevention. One of the inherent problems of public health is the anonymity of prevention. When you prevent something from happening, people tend not to notice. We focus a lot more on things that do happen. This leads to an inevitable bias towards disease rather than disease prevention, sickness rather than health, and healthcare rather than public health. So I'll highlight a few vaccine-preventable illnesses that may not capture much of our attention and often fly under the radar. Cholera is an acute intestinal infection caused by ingestion of food or water contaminated with a cholera bacterium. The annual burden of cholera has been estimated at 1.3 to 4 million cases and 21,000 to 143,000 deaths worldwide. Dengue fever is from a mosquito-borne virus, with 40% of the world's population at risk. Diphtheria is fatal in 5 to 10% of cases, with a higher mortality rate in young children. Human papillomavirus, HPV, causes cervical cancer, which is the fourth most common cancer in women, with an estimated 266,000 deaths and 528,000 new cases worldwide in 2012. Rotaviruses are the most common cause of severe diarrheal disease in young children throughout the world. About 250,000 children aged under 5 years die each year from vaccine-preventable rotavirus infections. The reawakened interest in immunizations and infectious disease epidemics has been spurred on by the measles outbreaks occurring in the U.S. this year and continuing today. For those of you who may not have followed the story, here is a quick review. This is from the Centers for Disease Control. Increase in measles cases, United States, January 1st through April 26, 2019. What is already known about this topic? Measles was eliminated in the United States in 2000. What is added by this report? During January 1st through April 26, a total of 704 cases were reported, the highest number of cases reported since 1994. Outbreaks in close-knit communities accounted for 88% of all cases. Of 44 cases directly imported from other countries, 34 were in U.S. residents traveling internationally. Most were not vaccinated. Unvaccinated U.S. residents traveling internationally are at risk for acquiring measles. Close-knit communities with low vaccination rates are at risk for sustained measles outbreaks. High coverage with measles, mumps, rubella, MMR vaccination is the most effective way to limit transmission and maintain elimination of measles in the United States. The median patient age was 5 years. Among the 44 internationally imported measles cases, 91% were in unvaccinated persons. All were age eligible for vaccination. Source countries included Philippines, Ukraine, Israel, Thailand, Vietnam, Germany, Algeria, France, India, Lithuania, Russia, and the United Kingdom. We live in a small world. Before 2019, the highest number of measles cases following elimination in the United States occurred in 2014, when 667 cases were reported. 57% of those cases were associated with an outbreak in an under-immunized Amish community in Ohio. Worldwide, 7 million measles cases are estimated to occur annually. And since 2016, measles incidence has increased in 5 of the 6 World Health Organization regions, contributing to increased opportunities for measles importations into the United States. Fortunately, the majority of importations do not lead to outbreaks because of rapid implementation of control measures by state and local health departments. Additionally, the United States benefits from a long-standing vaccination program, with overall measles vaccination coverage of over 91% in children aged 19 to 35 months. However, unimmunized or under-immunized subpopulations within U.S. communities are at risk for large outbreaks of long duration that are resource-intensive to control. Recent outbreaks have been driven by misinformation about measles and MMR vaccine, which has led to under-vaccination in vulnerable communities. Unvaccinated U.S. residents traveling internationally are at risk for acquiring measles. Healthcare providers should vaccinate persons without contraindications and without acceptable evidence of immunity to measles before travel to any country outside the United States. High coverage with MMR vaccine is the most effective strategy to limit transmission and maintain elimination of measles in the United States. Okay, and switching gears a little bit again, I want to cover a story from the Washington Post. My parents didn't tell me they skipped my vaccines. Then I got sick. In May 2016, I'd been feeling sick for a few days. My doctor diagnosed strep and sent me home with antibiotics, but this wasn't like any strep I'd ever had before. My sore throat and fever kept getting worse, and I developed a rash on one of my arms. Then one morning, I collapsed onto the floor of my apartment. The emergency room doctors took blood and ruled out strep, after all. Maybe it was scarlet fever. Then someone thought to ask, "Were you vaccinated against measles?" In my haze, I realized that I wasn't sure. I texted my mother the question. She responded with a thumbs down emoji. "Why?" she asked. "I'm in the hospital," I wrote back. Measles was like the worst flu I ever had, combined with the worst hangover I'd ever had. It flattened me. Mentally, I was disoriented. I'd gone to a teaching hospital, Northwestern Memorial in Chicago. So medical students would come by my bedside and ask if they could take photos of my rash, which had spread in pronounced red blotches. None of them had ever seen this disease in a person before. The United States had declared measles eliminated in 2000. Once my temperature fell and blood oxygen levels rose, the hospital released me with strict instructions to stay home. But before I'd become ill, I'd gone to a tech conference in Las Vegas with tens of thousands of attendees. I had no idea how many people I'd met, shaken hands with, or brushed up against. Measles is so contagious that if one infected person is in a room, 90% of the unvaccinated people around him will also become infected. The live virus can linger in the air for 2 hours after a cough or sneeze. Officials from the Illinois Department of Health got in touch. They established that I'd caught the measles at a graduation ceremony I'd attended before the conference at Northern Illinois University, where some visiting from another country had brought the disease. They then interviewed me about my whereabouts and followed up with loved ones, acquaintances, and anyone else I'd been in contact with to check if they were immunized. Fortunately, I hadn't passed the disease on to anyone else. It took me months to feel even close to normal. My heart rate was unusually elevated and I was fatigued. During that slow recovery, I had a long talk with my parents to try to understand my medical history. It turned out that I had never been vaccinated against any infection, not measles, not polio, not tetanus, in my 30 trips around the sun. It's hard to draw out the specifics of their beliefs or drill down to the root cause of their immunization denial. They don't believe that some vast conspiracy is imposing vaccines on us. They're just predisposed to be suspicious of, quote, unnatural medical intervention. And they stand behind their decision. I love them and I try not to judge them too harshly. Medical information is much more widely accessible now than it was in the 1980s when they were raising us and the measles vaccine became widely available. Still, people with that attitude have put their children's lives at risk. I felt a little dumb for not realizing sooner. My parents held all kinds of alternative beliefs. When someone in our family got sick, they turned to home remedies. They homeschooled my 7 siblings and me, and after that I took college classes remotely. I never passed through any of the usual institutional checkpoints, where some authority would ask for health records, so the subject never came up. I was just lucky that I hadn't got sick, or stepped on a nail before this. As soon as I could manage it, I called my doctor, and we drew up a 6-week schedule to catch me up on my immunizations. In the first few months of 2019, the United States has had its highest number of measles cases in the past 5 years. Actually, it's 25 years. The total may rise, especially because the number of people claiming vaccine exemptions for non-medical reasons has increased over the past decade. Vaccine skeptics brush off measles as a once common childhood illness, making it sound like a manageable nuisance, a rite of passage even. But they forget that it can lead to serious complications, including pneumonia and meningitis, and that it can be fatal. I contracted the disease as an adult in good health, and it landed me in the hospital. To this day, I still feel its effects. Years after people seem to recover, measles can suppress the immune system, effectively creating an immune amnesia that leaves them more vulnerable to other infections. When someone else gets close to me, I get the sniffles. I end up coughing for weeks. Worry about panencephalitis, in which virus lingering in the brain triggers a deadly immune response, also weighs on me. I tried to make vaccines an ongoing topic of conversation with my siblings, discussing the science and current medical consensus, in the hopes that they'd become more comfortable with the idea. A few are vaccinated, but it may take time for the gravity of the danger to fully sink in, and for everyone to take action. They don't seem opposed to it, but the risk of infection doesn't feel urgent. Everyone is healthy, so everything is fine, until it's not. Okay, most of the people who avoid or delay vaccinations are best described as suffering from vaccine hesitancy. A much smaller group of people would describe themselves as anti-vaxxers. Vaccine hesitancy emerges from fear and doubt about vaccine safety or vaccine effectiveness, often from the prodding of anti-vaxxers. The relatively small but growing number of Americans who are infected by vaccine hesitancy are driving vaccination levels down just enough to allow vaccine-preventable diseases to reemerge in the United States. Ironically, the effectiveness of vaccines has been part of the downfall of immunization rates, as protection from a host of vaccine-preventable infectious diseases seems insignificant compared to worries about prevention somehow being worse than the disease. To me, this seems like an odd use of a privileged condition of living in a society largely free of diseases which were a scourge in the past. So I'm going to tell a story about polio, a scourge of the past, almost eradicated in the world today. I believe that this history will better inform our understanding of where we are today. To tell this story, I'm using material from sciencehistory.org and technologyreview.com. In the early 1950s, 25,000 to 50,000 new cases of polio occurred each year in the United States. Jonas Salk became a national hero when he allayed the fear of the dreaded disease with his polio vaccine, approved in 1955. Although it was the first polio vaccine, it was not to be the last. Albert Sabin introduced an oral vaccine in the United States in the early 1960s that replaced Salk's. The disease was finally brought under control because of these vaccines. In the first half of the 20th century, summer was a dreaded time for children. Although they could enjoy the long days of unfettered play, summer was also known as polio season. Children were among the most susceptible to paralytic poliomyelitis, also known as infantile paralysis, a disease that affects the central nervous system and can result in paralysis. When exposed to the polio virus in the first months of life, infants usually manifested only mild symptoms because they were protected from paralysis by maternal antibodies still present in their bodies. However, as hygienic conditions improved and fewer newborns were exposed to the virus, which is present in human sewage, paralytic poliomyelitis began to appear in older children and adults who did not have an infant's benefit of immunity. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt is perhaps the most famous victim of the polio virus. In 1921, at the age of 39, he contracted the disease, one of the thousands that were afflicted that year. Jonas Salk invented the polio vaccine in 1953, but never patented it. He believed that, like the sun, a vaccine for polio belonged to the people. Salk tested the vaccine on himself and his own family first, and later went on to work on a cure for AIDS. Salk is impressive, but he must be talked about along with Albert Sabin, who discovered a vaccine around the same time and also didn't patent it. Salk and Sabin's vaccines are still used to prevent polio today. Franklin Delano Roosevelt played a big role in funding and awareness. FDR had contracted polio in 1921. In 1938, as president, he helped to found the now-titled March of Dimes Foundation. By the late 40s, the foundation was raising tens of millions a year with the help of celebrities like Mickey Mouse. And yes, for you anti-vaxxers, You are correct if you consider polio a Mickey Mouse disease. The March of Dimes Foundation funded Salk and helped him to become the first one to find a vaccine for polio. Still, having a vaccine is not enough by itself to deal with the scourge of infectious disease. A vaccine needs to reach enough people across a broad swath of society to root out patterns of endemic infections and waves of epidemics. In 1959, epidemiologists reported findings on the pattern of the disease. These suggested a shift in incidence according to age, geography, and race. By 1960, less than one-third of the population under 40 years of age had received the full course of 3 doses of the Salk vaccine plus a booster. Most of those who had received it were white and from middle and upper economic classes. The disease raged on in urban areas among African Americans and Puerto Ricans, and in certain rural locales among Native Americans and members of isolated religious groups. The gap had to do with access to vaccination. Pediatricians were not well compensated. This was the one thing they could do that was a guaranteed reasonable flow of cash. The physicians resisted losing that cash. They argued for a vaccine that required their professional training. Well, the practice of medicine perverted by profit motive is an age-old story. However, other pediatricians were more public health-minded. Beginning in January 1962, pediatricians in 2 Arizona counties, Maricopa and Pima, containing the state's largest cities, Phoenix and Tucson, conducted separate but similar voluntary mass immunizations using Sabin's vaccine. Previous programs in the county using the Salk vaccine had failed to bring polio immunization to a satisfactory level. They reported a year later in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The program was called SOS, Sabin Oral Sundays. More than 700,000 people were immunized, 75% of the total population in both counties. The vaccine was given at the cost of 25 cents for those who could pay. It was given to population groups that were socially, racially, and culturally diverse on Indian reservations and military posts and in urban and rural areas. The program became a model for subsequent U.S. mass immunization programs. By mid-1960s, Sabin's vaccine was the only one in use in the United States. It was the Sabin vaccine that closed the immunity gap and effectively put an end to polio in the United States. If the story of public health efforts to end polio does not give you some reasonable level of confidence in the profound value of vaccination, perhaps I'll share the story of smallpox eradication in another episode. Public health efforts are often far from perfect, yet the profound contribution that public health affords us generation after generation to this very day is undeniable. The bottom line, get vaccinated. Get your children and grandchildren vaccinated. Support your neighbors getting vaccinated. Together we can defend ourselves and each other from a host of infectious diseases that still inhabit the planet. Now I'm going to switch gears a bit and talk a bit about the many forms of conspiracy beliefs and scientific illiteracy that drives anti-vaccination efforts. First up, a more global perspective. Polio vaccinator is shot and killed in Pakistan. This is from the New York Times. 2 gunmen on motorcycles shot and killed a polio vaccinator in the southwestern Pakistani city of Chaman, bringing the death toll among vaccinators working in the country's anti-polio drive to at least 3 this week. The shooters opened fire on a group of vaccinators when they were at the front gate of a house in a remote village near the border with Afghanistan. Polio workers, volunteers, and their guards are frequently targeted in the South Asian country. Islamist militants and hardline clerics say the vaccination drive is a foreign plot to sterilize Muslim children and a cover for Western spies. We should be concerned about the killing of polio workers as it is adding more global pressure on us. It is mandatory now to introduce a comprehensive policy or legislation to get rid of crippling polio disease in the country. Recently, the government has started public education campaigns on the issue and urged Muslim clerics to inform the population that the vaccine protects children from a disease that can lead to paralysis or death. A global effort to eradicate the disease left Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria as the only countries that have not stopped the transmission of the polio virus, according to the World Health Organization. The number of cases of the disease in the country dropped to 12 in 2018, from 58 in 2012, according to End Polio Pakistan. According to an independent tally by the news media, 95 polio workers have been killed doing their work since 2012. This is despite the fact that vaccination efforts in Pakistan have often been the subject of suspicion and unfounded rumors that suggest that vaccines harm children. More than 25,000 children were rushed to hospitals in northwestern Pakistan after false rumors that polio drops were making children sick created a panic. A man, Nazir Ghul, was detained this month on suspicion of conspiring against the polio vaccination campaign after a video went viral that showed Mr. Ghul urging students to pretend to faint after immunization. Next up, a little closer to home, the small exploratory study that pointed to a potential link between the MMR vaccination and autism. You might call this the little study that wouldn't die. This from sciencebasedmedicine.org. The Lancet retracts Andrew Wakefield's article. In 1998, Andrew Wakefield and 11 other co-authors published a study with the unremarkable title, Ileolymphoid Nodular Hyperplasia, Nonspecific Colitis, and Pervasive Developmental Disorder in Children. Such a title would hardly grab a science journalist's attention, but the small study sparked a widespread hysteria about a possible connection between the measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, vaccine and autism spectrum disorder, ASD. The study itself has not stood the test of time. The results could not be replicated by other labs. A decade of subsequent research has sufficiently cleared the MMR vaccine of any connection to ASD. The lab used to search for measles virus in the guts of the study subjects has been shown to have used flawed techniques resulting in false positives. There does not appear to be any association between autism and a GI disorder. But it's okay to be wrong in science. There is no expectation that every potential finding will turn out to be true. In fact, it's expected that most new findings will eventually be found to be false. That's the nature of investigating the unknown. No harm, no foul. Andrew Wakefield, however, was apparently guilty of more than just getting it wrong, or even of being a sloppy scientist. He has been the subject of an ethics investigation by the General Medical Council, who recently concluded that the General Medical Council ruled he had acted dishonestly and irresponsibly in doing his research. What is also at issue, however, is the integrity of the published peer-reviewed medical research. Again, there is not the expectation that peer-reviewed research will always get the answer right. In fact, the published research stands as an important record of error. The blind alleys, red herrings, false correlations, and erroneous conclusions that are part of the history of science. However, error should not include scientific fraud or science that is thoroughly misrepresented. One aspect of the transparency demanded by science, and increasingly an issue, is disclosure of potential conflicts of interest. This is the issue that first got Wakefield in hot water with The Lancet, the journal that published his original research. Wakefield was being paid as an expert by lawyers who were suing over alleged vaccine injury. In fact, some of the children in the study were the children of parents who were suing. This is a massive conflict of interest. When this came to light, The Lancet responded by contacting the co-authors of the article and essentially asking them if they still stand by the results of the study. 10 of the 12 original authors of the study retracted their support for the study and its interpretation. In 2004, The Lancet published a retraction. This should be the final nail in the coffin of this controversial and harmful study, coming 12 years after the original paper, after just about every element of the research and its findings have been refuted. The Lancet retraction almost seems unnecessary, but it is necessary and important, as the retraction indicates it removes this dubious research from the published record. While we can all celebrate this move, I also believe it highlights the need for scientific journals to have a lower threshold in retracting published studies that are found to be fraudulent and are so flawed either ethically or scientifically that they should never have been published in the first place. I applaud The Lancet for finally retracting the Wakefield study and removing it from the published record. It should not, however, have taken this long. Well, folks, that does it for today's show. Please support vaccination efforts. Millions of lives depend on it. If you have comments for this show, please email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.